when we're planning the conference, we thought that we wanted to make sure we had a session devoted to just talking about the papers that were presented and the issues that those papers brought about. And when we were thinking about, well, who could we have to comment on these papers, the three commentators we have are exactly the three we were hoping to get. So it's I've been looking forward to this session in particular all day. I'm going to introduce all three of them right now, and I suppose you guys can just speak in the order I introduce you. Go for about 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'll just open it up for comments among the panelists and then with the audience as well. I'm going to keep the introductions short just for the sake of time. Dr. Chad Pecknold received his PhD from the University of Cambridge, now a professor at the Catholic University of America. His books include Christianity and Politics, A Brief Guide to the History, and The Clark Companion to Augustine and Modern Theology. He writes all the time in places like First Things and in National Review. Sharif Gurgis has spent a lot of time pursuing very impressive degrees from Princeton, from Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, back to Princeton again where he's pursuing his PhD and his JDs from the Yale Law School. The pursuit of those degrees hasn't interfered with doing actual scholarship. He was co-author with Robert George and Ryan Anderson, a very influential book titled What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense. And is just about to come out, right?
Mm-hmm.
With a very important, another co-authored volume, Debating Religious Liberty, that's co-authored with Ryan Anderson and John Corvino, Debating Religious Liberty and Discrimination, and that's Oxford University Press in a couple weeks.
Next week.
On
Amazon,
$4.99. Adrian Renewal is the Ralph S. Tyler Jr. Professor of Constitutional Law at Harvard University. He was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2012. He has authored or co-authored 8 books, according to my account. I read his bio, and it made me feel bad about myself, as we're about the same age. His most recent book is Law's Abnegation, From Law's Empire to the Administrative State, an extraordinarily important book on administrative law. Please join me in welcoming our panelists.
You want me to start?
Wherever you want.
Sure.
I was told no more than 10 minutes. I'll try not to take that much time. I'm very grateful to be here, and I've learned so much from our speakers. Thank you to the Thomistic Institute and to the University of Notre Dame and to the New York University. It's great to be here. The connections between the papers that I made have to do with something that was rarely spoken of, but Professor Kessler actually did finally raise it, is the image of God. This, of course, Professor Kessler is perfectly right to say that when we have indicated our capacity to partake of the eternal reason, eternal law, we're also talking about the image of God. And this is something Professor Bigger also talked about, raising the issue of Vittoria, one of the Salamanca school, and discussing the human person created with a rational nature, born free and moral. And then identifying in Ritchie, the line that I noted was that Ritchie concedes the individual self as a manifestation of universal reason, maybe a basis of natural rights. It seems to me that you need some account of either the highest common good or the supreme good or the eternal reason manifested in the human nature in order to have an intelligible discussion about natural rights. Vittoria argued that dominion and use, that our ability to use things, to have dominion over other creatures, to have rights, is grounded in the image of God, and that man is the image of God by nature. That is, this is a quote from Vittoria, by his rational powers. True ownership and rights did not rest on a particular person in question exhibiting full rational agency. Vittoria made the obvious point that children, and I'm grateful for Professor Legge's wonderful discourse in raising the question of children having natural rights. Vittoria made the obvious point that children, even before the use of reason, still bear the image of God. What matters from a moral and legal standpoint in the instances of children and the irreversibly amentes, those who are without full capacity of reason, those have natural right, regardless of whether they are able to exhibit full rational agency or even possess the capability to express themselves. Rather, it is the actual expression of their reason. Rather, it is that they, Vittoria notes that it is that each of these figures, the amentes and the child who is not of the age of reason, can iniurum. They can suffer something which takes away their use, their iure. They can suffer injury. And because they can suffer injury, then there can be this infringement of their dignity as bearers of God's image, as innocent persons made to God's image, Vittoria says. We had Professor Kessler talk about the line, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." In what? Equal in dignity. Dignity due to our being Capax Dei. Our dignity comes from our ability, as the early church father said, to stand up straight, pointed towards heaven, pointed towards God. That we are all equally in God's image by nature, regardless of how fully actualized this capacity is. Vittoria writes, "Man is Capax Domini, Capax Jus, precisely because he is Capax Dei." Thomas understands all creatures to have a certain limited likeness to God, but sees the image and likeness of God to belong to angelic and human creatures above all. The teleological order is reflected in this, not only in the relation between rational and non-rational creatures, but in understanding the image in man relative to the image in angels, where he finds a right ordering. Even among human creatures, Thomas understands the image of God to be equal in all in an absolute sense, as well as understanding the image of God to be hierarchically ordered towards the common good. Hierarchically ordered in terms in which one can be more or less in the image of God. One can be just and be more in the image of God than the unjust. That the blessed are more in the image of God than the just. That there is a hierarchical ordering as well as an absolute ordering for the image of God. And this is the proper framework in which you have a full-scale hierarchical order that nominalism and voluntarism cuts off, collapses down, and thus we collapse down our account of natural rights, which is perfectly fitting with the Catholic understanding. But we've seen, I think, what happens when it's abstracted from a fully hierarchical view of a teleological world. I probably used it my tongue. Salamanca School Dominican Thomas, who I would have liked to have heard a lot more about, recognized humanity's ontological equality and spiritual moral capacity for God is the condition for understanding what is owed to a person. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me. This is awesome as usual. I feel like one of these things is like the other. But I'm grateful to be here. So I was asked to just respond to some of the talks, and the way an academic responds to talks is to say, here's what was wrong with the first one, here's what was wrong with the other, and here's how my view completes and corrects the other. So I'll do a little bit of that, but I'll try to be moderate about it. So the question, the main question for the day is, are there natural rights? And if there are natural rights, there's some species of moral principles, I think. And in that realm, I think one way to approach the question of whether there are natural rights is whether there's a distinctive job for this kind of moral principle to perform, either in telling us what to do or in explaining why we have the duties that we do. And I took Professor Bigger's talk as really just pressing that question. Is there a distinctive job for natural rights to do? He granted that there's objective morality. There are natural answers about what I ought to do and ought not to do. And then he granted that there are specific duties, there are rights in that sense, that are legal rights. But those aren't natural because they depend on social institutions. So he thinks there are specific duties that are not natural, and natural duties that are pretty general, but there isn't a middle category of natural duties that are specific, which is what he thinks the language of rights suggests. And I think that was the question, in my head, that was the question set up for the day. Are there natural duties that are specific in the ways, specific or stringent or absolute in the ways that rights talk suggests? And I took Father Legge to be answering that question to some extent and saying Aquinas has an answer to that question. He makes room for natural rights. He thinks there are natural facts about what I owe to you in particular. And that really, you can just move back and forth between talking about the duties I have and the rights you have with respect to me. And if there is any further job for rights to do, it's the same job that duties have, which is to point to the good, the human good as individuals, as communities, and the demands that the human good make on us. So I like all of that, and I think all of that is right as far as it goes. But as I was suggesting in my questions to him, I think that Professor Bigger's talk leaves a further question for Father Legge's view. If you can say everything in terms of duties that you would have wanted to say in terms of rights, then why move to rights talk? And in particular, why move to rights talk if it seems to have all the risks that Professor Bigger suggested that it has, that it tends to mislead you into thinking that there are these natural, universal facts about very specific obligations that you have? He pointed to the ways that Ritchie says that natural rights talk distorts our understanding of what we ought to do. So the question still remains, given that you can frame some duties in terms of rights, is there a distinctive job for rights to do? And in particular, what you get with rights talk that you don't have with duties is the idea of someone holding the right. So what's the benefit of framing the duty from the perspective of someone who is thought to hold it? I think the way that that question becomes most acute is if you have a vision of the good that's pretty generic. So for example, Bentham, you quoted Professor Bigger quoted, I forget if it's Bentham or Mill, who says that rights talk is nonsense on stilts.
Bentham.
Right. So I think the reason he had that view is he would agree with the general idea that if rights have a job, it's to point us towards the demands of the good. But for him, the good is just one single quantity that you get more or less of, and that every person is just an occasion of. It's pleasure or pain, or in more sophisticated forms of utilitarianism, it's like satisfaction of preferences or something like that. And if you have that view, then there's really just one moral principle, which is maximize that one thing. And from that perspective, the fact that it's this person's pleasure versus that one's pleasure, the fact that it's this kind of pleasure versus that one, at least in certain forms of the theory, won't make a difference. So there's no distinctive job for natural rights to do. And if you talk in terms of natural rights, you'll lose sight of the one thing that really matters on this view, which is the sum total pleasure net by pain in society. So I think that kind of view really sharpens the question. If rights are about the good, then what additional role do they have to play that isn't just distorting? So I think this suggests that natural rights will have a job to do if the good is variegated. if there's a multiplicity of goods. And in general, I think natural rights have the job, so to speak, of forcing us to respect the variety of kinds of good that there are and of the people whose good makes demands on us. So it pushes us against the idea of thinking that the human good is just about a single thing like pleasure or pain, and against the idea that thinking that your good is just fungible with mine, so that all we need to do is maximize the total good in the room as opposed to respecting the demands of different people's goods. So the benefit of framing rights in terms of the person who holds them is as a way of pressing the point that each person has a well-being that makes a separate demand on you morally. That it's not just about summing and maximizing the total, but about respecting the separate and independent demands that this person's good makes on you and that person's good makes on you. That's a kind of lesson that we draw from rights talk, because rights are framed in terms of their beneficiaries. There's something that someone holds over against you. And the other reason that rights matter is, again, to remind us not just of the variety of people whose goods matter, but of the kinds of goods that are to be respected, because different rights will pick out different goods for protection. And the idea that this is a separate right from that one means that you can't just forget about one dimension of my good if you think you can maximize the other. So to say that the right to life is one right, and the right to religious liberty, or the right to free speech, or the right to a fair trial is another right, is to say that you can't simply attack one of these as a means to another if you think that'll produce more good overall. There are different dimensions of each person's well-being, and a just society will be respecting each of them to some extent, promoting the conditions for each of them to some extent, and will avoid trampling one kind of good as a means to another. And in particular, it will avoid intending harm to one good as a means to another, if they're both basic goods, if they both make separate demands on me. And I think this account of what rights talk is doing and of what the point of natural rights is coheres with a lot of what's been said. It points to the fact that the right is about the good. It explains the fact that there's a benefit to talking about rights from the perspective of the person whose good is being served. And then I think it also tells us when rights are specific and absolute, in the way that Professor Bigger was questioning, and when they're not. If the right in question is picking out a basic aspect of an individual's good, for example, his or her life, then intending harm to that as a means to another is to collapse back into the utilitarianism we were talking about earlier, to fail to respect the variety of goods and of people whose goods make demands on us. It's a way of... So there are some absolute rights, and they're just the rights that pick out the most basic dimensions of a person's well-being that are not replaceable with other dimensions of their well-being or with the well-being of society as a whole. So in this way, different rights do point us to the good, but to different dimensions of the good, and they undercut the impulse to simply maximize the good. And that's why a theory, a moral theory that says, well, morality is just about maximizing the good, will be most likely to think that natural rights are nonsense on stilts. Thanks.
Okay, well, many thanks to Father White and Father Legg for inviting me. It's been a great pleasure. I feel as though I'm somewhat out of depth, out of my depth in this company of theologians and political theorists, moral theorists. You have to understand, we lawyers are sort of lower on the academic chain of being, the great chain of being. So what I hope to do is make some kind of contribution just by posing a question for each of our primary speakers from a lawyer's standpoint, that is a positive lawyer's standpoint. I think in all of the talks, there were express or implied comparisons with positive law that could be made sharper or could be fruitful grounds for conversation. So let me start with Nigel a bit. And I have two questions. I get not so much for Nigel as I suppose for Richie, about Richie's express and implied comparisons with positive law. So the first one is, I believe that hearing it from your account, it seems to me that Richie radically overestimates the specificity, fixity, and stability of positive legal rights in either common law or civil law legal systems. So this would be a kind of nirvana fallacy, which is a comparison of an idealized state on one side of an equation with a non-ideal state on the other side of the equation. So it would be a kind of comparison of natural rights with all their warts and problems on the one hand with an idealized picture of positive law on the other hand. So positive legal rights are chronically, maybe always, subject to vague override provisos for public order, for unreasonable exercise of rights, for compelling governmental interests, and so on and so forth, ad nauseum. And if Ritchie's critique about ill-defined circumstantial overrides counts as a successful objection to natural rights, I think it also counts as a successful objection to positive legal rights, and the consequence would be that there are no rights anywhere. So I think we need some account of the comparison that's more successful than Ritchie gives. There might be a confusion in Ritchie between the fixity and stability and specificity of right definition on the one hand and the likelihood of rights enforcement on the other hand. So in a state of nature, it may or may not be true that there's a lower certainty of enforcement of rights, lower certainty that the right will be respected. That's an analytically distinct issue from the fixity or stability of the definition of the right itself. So a second question for Ritchie is, it seems to me that running throughout his argument was a kind of confusion about the defeasibility of rights. That is, the confusion being that if one could show that natural rights are defeasible under a substantial range of circumstantial conditions, that it would undermine the right itself, showing either the natural right is non-existent or at least non-absolute. For positive legal rights, I don't think we typically think that. That is, defeasibility under special circumstances doesn't show that the baseline right didn't exist, or even that it's not absolute. That the lawyer's typical response to defeasibility is to say that defeasibility shows a conflict with other rights, and the consequence is a process of adjustment in which the baseline right is treated as though it has scope conditions that have to be specified. So what we do is we work on the scope conditions and make it more precise and build the defeasibility conditions into the definition of the right itself. But it remains true that the baseline right can be understood as strongly binding within its newly defined scope, and the override conditions don't threaten its character in that sense. So we just treat rights as though they have implied ceteris paribus clauses rather than somehow throwing them out altogether. And it wasn't clear to me why Ritchie didn't take that tack. Okay, so that was all for Nigel. For Father Legg, my positive law comparison was, I guess, more constructive. And just as to renew something we discussed on email a little bit. So the thought was that your very illuminating picture of Aquinas's view of rights has a clear analog in the positive legal system that might be illuminating in its turn. And this is a category of what we might call role-dependent rights or relational rights. So let me explain. So I have in mind here things like the rights of criminal defense attorneys or whistleblowers or so-called red team members or devil's advocates in national security decision-making. All these actors are given rights that they hold individually and that they can assert individually, but that are justified on systemic grounds in terms of the rationally purposive functioning of an overall scheme. So for the criminal defense attorney in an adversarial system of justice, the thought is the attorney can assert rights, perhaps derivatively the client's rights, but that doesn't matter, can assert rights on an individual basis, but the point of giving them those rights is to promote the overall well-functioning of the adversarial system. It seems to me that kind of structure has exactly this two-level quality that you refer to, and that it's not useful to characterize the criminal defense attorney's rights as either subjective or objective. That's just sort of not the right categorization for them. That the key distinction is between individual scope and systemic justification, and that's fits your picture perfectly. So I just hope that's in some way useful. Finally, for Charles Kessler, I had a little bit of a deflationary thought about the Declaration of Independence, which comes from a book by David Armitage. In Armitage's thesis, or one of his theses, is that the Declaration of Independence is misunderstood because people don't understand that it is, in essence, it's a legal document. Rather than a political theory treatise or anything more elevated, the claim is that, look, Jefferson was a lawyer, and the template that was used for the Declaration of Independence is, in essence, a legal complaint under the law of nations. So the Declaration closely follows a typical format for complaints, which is first a statement of the counts. So this is the, you know, charges against the British crown, and then an appeal to the tribunal, that is the supreme judge of the world refracted through the opinions of mankind. And then finally, for complaints under the contemporary law of nations, a typical complaint ends in a statement of invocation of a self-help remedy, which is the standard remedy under the law of nations. So in the Declaration of Independence, the self-help remedy is, of course, secession. So on this view, there's nothing theoretically very elevated. We should imagine Jefferson, you know, taking templates from his many law books and transposing them for immediate political purposes without any necessarily grand horizons. I don't know whether that's actually right or not, but it's a kind of an interestingly downbeat perspective on the enterprise. Thank you.
Very good. I've never heard the right of revolution described as a self-help remedy. I guess it fits, yeah. Here, we have one microphone that will pass in between you. Do you want to, the first panelist, do you want to start with a response to the comments and then Adrian's questions? Why don't we just start in order? Nigel, do you want to begin?
Sure. So thanks to all three of you for really good sets of comments. Not wanting to take all of your time, I'll make three comments to each of you. I mean, one each. First on the image of God, just to say, yes, I agree. A lot hangs on how you interpret what the image means, and of course, the Bible itself is not particularly specific. To observe that much of the tradition has gone from the image of God to rationality, which can mean all sorts of things, and moral philosophers take it in the direction of a strong notion of autonomy, which Christians might not want to follow. If one understands the image of God in terms of what follows in the text, namely the, as it were, delegation of responsibility by God to human beings, what you end up with is some notion not merely of rationality but of responsible rationality, that's to say rationality under the law of God.
Dominion.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not an absolute, it's subordinate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just to make that comment. If I can move then to Adrian, I'll end up with, what's your first name? Again?
Sharif.
Sharif, last. So Adrian, yes, you, first of all, a confession, I think the target might be me rather than Richie, because I'm the one who was hung up on fixity and stability, and that's fine. And I take the point that there is a distinction to be made between, as it were, fixity of definition and the likelihood of enforcement, and that I take on board, so thank you for that. Secondly, the point you made about feasibility doesn't, as it were, undermine the existence of a right. That's also well taken. I think the instance of that I mentioned was from Vittoria, and it has to do with the right of travel. The problem there is it is unqualified, as far as I can tell, at all. It's simply a right to travel, which, as it stands, doesn't make sense to me, and needs further specification. But then the complaint may be not against the concept of a natural right so much as certain rights talk, that is just too unqualified. Then third, and this is to Sheriff, though I think it touches on something Adrian mentioned too. Okay, so what is gained by moving to let's say, from talking in terms of natural duties to natural rights, or what difference is made? Here's an example of why I remain concerned. It has to do with the ethics of war. According to traditional just war thinking, and according to the international laws of war, international humanitarian law, it is permissible. What you have been to do is to strike civilians intentionally or disproportionately. You have a duty of discrimination, that's to say, you mustn't target civilians intentionally, and even if it's unintentionally, there has to be a proportionate reason for risking their lives. Some people want to replace that with international human rights law, according to which civilians have a right to life. Now, what difference does that make? Well, it might not make any difference, provided you remember the right to life is qualified.
Mm-hmm.
I just observed that in public discourse, the qualifications get lost. So in my own country, debates recently about the killing of civilians in Yemen by the Saudis. We supply arms to the Saudis. In a recent parliamentary report, there were complaints about the violation of international law because of the large number of civilians killed, to which my response is, well, that might or might not be a violation of the law according to whether the killing was intentional and disproportionate, which you haven't shown. But they dropped that. So, but again, the complaint then would be against, not as it were, the concept, but the way in which the concept tends to be used or have used.
Well, thank you very much for your three comments, and also to you, Nigel, for your comments just now, which I'd also like to maybe flag a question we can circle back to, about the right to life and just war, and which I think also raises very interesting questions. But first, Chad, about the image of God. I think maybe I'd just like to say something that I didn't... that I never really thought of before I started working on this paper, and that as I was working on it, and I don't think I really brought it out as clearly in the text, about the image of God and the question of rights and justice and so forth. Before I started working on this, I probably would have said, well, the image of God is just rooted in our human nature. Aquinas was, it's just rooted in our human nature, and therefore, you know, that is all you need to have a kind of rights theory. But after working on this and seeing the problem that develops when you abstract a kind of definition of what man is and start building rights on that, that turns into a problem later because you forget that the order and orientation that good needs to be in there. So that caused me to start looking again at the image of God texts. And one of the things that Aquinas does very clearly say
is that that image of God is not just that we're rational and free, but we're rational and free to know and love God.
Absolutely.
And that's the reason.
That's the hierarchical dimension.
Yeah, exactly. So that when he has a text where he talks about, well, I think actually it might even be the same quadlibet that I was quoting from.
Mm-hmm.
In one of the objections. So it's about worship, the worship of God.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes the observation there, just like a little throwaway line, that the reason we have the gift of reason is so that we can order ourselves to God.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a nice way, I think, of seeing that even that is understood in the fact that we are creatures that come from God and are meant to return to him.
Mm-hmm.
And we always are, even if you just abstract our rationality, you know, from that order, for Aquinas, it never exists without that order. Okay, with respect to Adrian, I'm going to skip over Sharif for a moment. I'm very grateful for your clarification, and actually, or your analog in positive law about role-dependent rights, and it makes me think of, it seems to me it's very close to, or maybe even the same as, the way Aquinas talks about the rights of a sovereign, which I didn't talk about, but that's one when I cataloged all the ways that somebody has a subjective right. That pops up over and over, that a sovereign has rights in his kingdom, and there are consequences for that, which might be interesting for political theory. But I think that's a role-dependent right, just like what you identified. Mm. Sharif, okay, yours is, in a way, the question that I you asked it in response to my presentation, and I think I didn't quite get it, and now I think I get it a little more, and I'd like to go on offense against you rather than answering defensively. You were asking, is there a distinctive job for rights to do? And it seems like, on my account, there wouldn't really be any need to appeal to rights because you could just, it's just rights, duties, those are two mirror images. Okay, yes, there's something to that. But I'd say, watch out. You're jumping very quickly to talking about duties, which I did not. I think the word showed up maybe one time in the paper, which was very intentional. Ernest Fortin, when he talks about Aquinas, and he talks about subjective-objective rights, he says, oh, the big problem with subjective rights is that you forget the duties. And we really need to go back to duties. But in fact, this is the typical move of a moral theology that thinks law is an imposition of a moral obligation by a superior will that gives me a duty to do whatever the lawgiver has commanded. And Aquinas does not really, I mean, he does talk about being, there is a notion of obligation in Aquinas. Obviously, justice is about giving someone his due, so you can transform that into talking about duty. But Aquinas much more dominantly talks about the good, the ordering to the good. And the danger with immediately transposing it into duties is that you begin to lose that. So I want to maybe say, well, your question is presupposing already part of the problem. Now, then to answer your question, do rights help you? Do you need them? I would say, well, Aquinas doesn't put rights at the center of his account, although he can account for them. So I'm not sure that I have to put them at the center of the account either, if I want to just say I'm going to be a pure Thomist. But rights did become important later. Why? It's useful in some contexts, and I think maybe, this is just a hunch, but I think maybe it's as a response to positivism. So what was the problem with the Spanish colonies and the enslavement that's happening there? You have a sovereign, and there's not even really an inner... I mean, it's hard to even have a natural, like, law of nations response to what the sovereign is doing. You can tell the sovereign, the preacher can stand up and say, hey, you're committing an injustice. But maybe that doesn't have that much traction. And what they, I think what they wanted to say is, you're not just enacting unjust laws that the natives could disobey, but you're injuring them, and they, in a way, have a claim against you. They can stand up against. There's something that can stand up against the positive authority. That's just a hunch.
Right. The hour is getting late, but so I don't want to. I don't want to do more than acknowledge the elegance of all three comments, and of course commentators, and thank them for that. I'll say something in response, really, only to Sharif's question, which I think is an interesting one. That is, what is the distinctive job of natural rights as opposed to natural duties or other formulations of natural justice? Well, I think two things. One is, unlike natural duties or even the general, let's say, legal character of Thomas Aquinas's natural law doctrine, natural rights are useful to limit government. And this becomes important in for two contingent reasons, perhaps, but very important contingent reasons. One is, if government and the church are close together and mutually reinforcing in their authority, then the ambitions of government can become quite tyrannical. Government is not just about you're obeying the law, you know, and being a law-abiding citizen. It's about having the right opinions. It's about believing in the right way, the right things. And so government has to get inside your soul somehow and make sure on this, with this new ambition, it has to get inside your soul and make sure you are holy or that you're moral for the right reasons and not simply conforming for outward reasons. But secondly, at the same time that there is that danger in government's ambition, there's also a swelling of government's power and means because of the emergence of modern science. So you now have, not only does government have this new end, it has fantastic new means that it can bring to the pursuit of those ends. And the combination of the end and the means makes perhaps an unprecedented situation of danger, in which perhaps it is the only response is to change the fundamental nature of the public moral teaching from one of lawful obedience and dutiful submission to legitimate authority, to a very insistent emphasis on the limitations of authority and the arming of individuals with legal causes of action and political causes of action, so to speak, that that might allow them to actually resist government in its ambitions and its accumulation of means. But secondly, I think the other more positive way or more positive part of a new agenda that natural rights open up is really the flourishing of civil society in a strange way. I mean, because on the one hand, the effect of natural rights is to try to stretch the distance between the individual and government, so that the individual has more freedom of action to resist government. But that freedom of action also allows individuals to create civil society, to fill it with institutions, with schools, with churches, with hospitals, with corporations, with all of the voluntary, the areas of, you know, voluntary associations in life. And all of these things are useful in limiting government in some ways, but they're also useful in allowing the individual to pursue his own goods and his own idea of the good, you know, armed with a certain kind of legal, moral, and social protection and encouragement as he goes. So that, it seems to me, is how I would begin to answer what it was a very provocative question about the what difference overall the switch to rights makes.
Very good.
Can I make a few? Yeah, let's let Sharif respond, but first I'm going to pile on it. Good. I'm going to articulate what I think is just a more narrow way of expressing what maybe Charles just said, and maybe Dominic as well. Doesn't the specific work of rights tell you who is responsible for executing the duties? So think of religious liberty. You have a moral obligation, a natural moral obligation to worship God. But who tells you how to do it, or who gets to execute that? And the right says it's my obligation, and I get to, right, execute worship properly to the way I think, right? And that's what the rights language would add, that the duty, I mean, if you just had the duty, that duty could be, you could be encouraged, put it that way, to fulfill your duty. The right specifies, and this gets to the inalienable part of religious liberty. No, that I have that duty. The nature of that duty, it can only be fulfilled by me, and that's what the right communicates.
Great. So a couple things. These are all really helpful. I should say up front that I think this is, my questions may have overstated how much I think there's a distinct, stable category of natural rights. The thing that I think is natural and objective and universal is the content of what I ought to do or ought not to do. And I think there's some relativity and contextualization of the different ways we frame the content of that. You know, obligations in terms of duties or in terms of rights, natural rights or civil rights or otherwise. So with that general framework in mind, I'll just say a few things quickly. So, Father Legge, when I was saying what's added in terms of talking about rights as opposed to just duties, I could have framed the same question with something besides duty. So what, as I said it earlier just now, you know, besides saying I ought to do X, what does it add to say that someone has a right that I do X? So I ought not to torture John. I ought not to torture Fido the dog. The first thing is grounded, we want to say, in John's rights. The second thing is not correlated with Fido's rights. So there must be something more we're saying when we talk about rights. And what is that in that kind of context? And when you say, well, maybe it's a way of highlighting the fact that rights stand over and against positive structures and social practices and law. But I think the same question arises there. I mean, once we say that there are pre-political facts about what ought to be done, we've already got enough material to criticize certain social structures as unjust. Then the question is, what further thing is added by rights? And you said at the end, you sort of got to that. You started to acknowledge that point, and then you said, well, maybe the thing that rights talk adds is that I have a claim that you not do this. But I think that just repeats the question. In other words, what does it add to say that I have a claim over and against you? And I'll say a little bit in a second about what I think that might mean. So Charles makes the point that, well, certain kinds of natural rights talk arose in a historically situated way in a reaction to abuses of government. And I agree with that. And I think that really specifies, especially civil rights and liberties and human rights talk in a certain context. But I was taking it for granted that natural rights are something that a private citizen can violate as well. So, you know, someone who tortures me will violate my natural right. And so I was looking for an account that explained that more expansive concept. What I think is that, as I suggested earlier, there are just different contextual purposes for rights talk in different realms. And when we talk about rights holders, we might mean one of maybe three different things. One is the beneficiary of the right, the person whose good explains why I ought to do X or not X. And in, for Aquinas at least, John's well-being explains why I ought not to torture him, but Fido's well-being does not explain why I ought not to torture Fido, because for Aquinas, our obligations bottom out in the human good, so I ought not to torture Fido because it'll make me worse towards people. So I think that's one case where the thing that is added by saying there's a rights holder is by talking about whose benefit grounds the fact that I have this obligation. But sometimes when we talk about rights holders, we really mean the one who's exercising it.
And that really goes to Adrian's point about, well, we talk about the rights of whistleblowers, and those aren't justified. They don't have the rights that they have in virtue of anything about their own well-being. They have that right in virtue of its role in a certain broader order. So there, by the rights holder, we just mean the one exercising it. And then this has come up several times, and it may have been behind your point about, well, someone has a claim against me. Sometimes by the rights holder, we mean the person whom it is most fitting to give the social power to demand restitution for the violation of a right, right? And, you know, in the torts context, this may come up. To say that I have a right not to be assaulted is more than to say that you ought not to assault me. It's to say that if you assault me, I am the person who deserves restitution. So I think there are just different purposes for rights talk in different forms, and the answer to what rights talk adds is going to be varied in this way, because the answers to what it adds to say this is the rights holder will vary.
Okay. One or two questions?
Well, I have a brief comment. I mean, I think we often, or at least people of my maybe intellectual leanings, view with suspicion when people talk about animal rights or the rights of the earth, because we think at the best that's misplaced language. And I do think that's misplaced language. But I think in a world where rights language is the almost unique category in which people can express a kind of order of wisdom or justice, it's a limping conceptual tool with which to talk about something that thinks real. I do think that there's complicated and interesting ways to think about how the order of justice encompasses non-rational creatures and the larger environment. And I can think of at least three. One is God is the author, ultimately, metaphysically, of the order of the world, including the hierarchically differentiated and interdependent network of things we call the environment and its ecosystems. And so even if it didn't harm another person immediately, there are ways I could act against the world that God has created that would indignify the reality I act against, say if I torture the dog, but also myself as made in the image of God. And so I think there would be ways to which in doing these things, even if no one ever found out or never harmed anybody else or caused me to harm anyone else, it would still be a kind of disorientation of my life toward God and towards God's creation. I mean, a second obvious way, and this is kind of connected with the whistleblowers and the sort of systems relative senses of justice, is that if you act against the environment in such a way that you destroy the capacity for well-being for generations to come after you, you have degraded the system in such a way that you've harmed the human community. It seems to me that's an obvious way in which you could generate something like an order of justice outside of the human community, but that's relative to the human community. I do also think there are more numinous and yet nevertheless objective ways of talking about this with regards to the aesthetic beauty of creation. And just like, for example, causing a species to die out, if you really believe in some way it's all somehow a vestige of divine wisdom, and divine wisdom is present in it as sustaining it in being and giving it its kind of relative modest glory, If you eradicate by negligence something that God is a kind of manifestation of the hidden God in his numinous beauty in the creation, you do a kind of aesthetic injustice to the divine wisdom. So I know that these are peripheral, but I think that there are interesting ways to think about how we can speak in our own traditions of more Christian concepts of justice to some of the things our contemporaries do when they use these extremely inflated notions of rights talk in strange ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to say one further thing about this, and to connect this point, which I agree with entirely, back to some of what we were talking about, and to put it in a theological context, Aquinas, so order, the order of the whole, it's not just the order of rational creatures, it also is the order of the whole cosmos. So we're an important part of the cosmos, but not the only part. And we're able to order ourselves to God in a way that other creatures can't. So that's what's distinctive about our rationality. and why we're proper subjects of receiving law, because we can understand in a way that irrational creatures can't. They just are ordered. We order ourselves. Okay, but when Aquinas talks about the effects of sin, so now we're stepping into theology here, but he thinks that at the fall of man, so the first sin, causes a disorder in our soul, in Adam's soul, or the human soul, vis-a-vis God, because we've turned away from what God's order, and have chosen an order for ourselves that's different from his. So it involves what we place as our good. So it involves a turning to another good. And it produces disorder in the cosmos. In us, it's the disorder of our lower nature, like our passions become unruly, they rebel. And then you have disorder in the cosmos, like, even the fact that we would experience threats from nature, like nature could kill you. Which Aquinas thinks in a way is a consequence of the fall, like you're going to be killed by a tree toppling over you, or something, or an earthquake. I'm not sure that I have a final punchline.
Yeah, let's get one or two more about it. Tell us who you are.
Brian Blackie. Sharif, in your comments, you said that you believe that the idea of rights was a useful tool to protect against the utilitarian impulse to make right, to make goods monolithic and isolated. So my question is, I always view the idea of rights as somehow married to the utilitarian harm principle, whereby, to state in one way, I can do whatever I want as long as I don't violate another person's rights. The very idea of injury is the idea of violating the right. So my question is, in practice it seems that rights often goes hand in hand with utilitarianism, whereas you're saying that this idea of rights is a guard against it. So do you see that tension? And if so, is that a difference in our definitions of what we're talking about? Or are you advocating a reformation of the idea of rights? Or do you think that the idea of rights as espoused by us is compatible?
Yeah, so I think that there's a lot, it's very common to, and I think this is the sort of political analog of what you're talking about at the individual level. It's common to conceptualize rights, Dworkin does, for example, as trumps on positive pursuits, right? So the state, in his case, can do whatever it wants to in terms of its policies so long as it doesn't violate rights, which are trumps, so that whatever the worth of the policy, if it violates this right, it's not to be done. And I think that poses too stark a difference between natural rights and the common good. I'd prefer to think of rights as principles that direct us to respect and promote some aspects of the common good. It's just that some of those aspects are best served, at least in a certain historical situation, by a system that's thinking about and trying to honor rights with the features that we think that they have. So it's a kind of standing general imperative to avoid imposing too much on certain forms of freedom, or to avoid attacking some aspects of a person's well-being, whether as a means to some other aspect of his well-being or to the common good in some other way. But it's really just it's a set of principles that direct us to part of this continuous thing called the common good that doesn't stand totally over and against it the way that it does in Dworkin's theory.
I'm enough of a nerd that I find it painful to conclude the deliberations that we've been having today. I do want to note that this is, although we have these day-long conferences frequently, this has been an exceptionally rich and really very rewarding day of just instruction, intelligence, courtesy, academic engagement, and reflection on something essential. And so I came here today to learn a lot about this. Is not my domain at all. And I was richly rewarded, as I think we all feel we were. And every one of the members sitting up here on the panel contributed just in a fantastic way. Please help me thank all our participants.